to The Curious Clinicians, a medical podcast that asks why. I'm Hannah Abrams, and I'm joined as always by Tony Brew and Avi Cooper. Hey, guys.
Good evening.
Hey, Hannah.
Hello, hello.
We're back at it.
All right, back in the studio. Today on the podcast, we are going to be discussing a pulmonary physiology question. So, Avi, I can see your massive excitement.
Yes.
You're a pulmonologist, you're an intensivist. But, you know, we haven't talked about that many pulmonary critical care topics on the show. So I am looking forward to learning from you today. What are we learning about?
Hannah, you're right. We have broached a few pulmonary and critical care topics on the episodes that I've led. We talked about albuterol-induced lactic acidosis. We've talked about propofol-related infusion syndrome. And of course, one of my personal favorites of the episodes, at least that I've helped lead, was the man who purposely paralyzed himself back in episode 46. And, you know, so I really enjoy actually not talking about pulmonary and critical care topics on this show because it's what I talk about all day clinically, but we're back at it, you know, we're doing it again, you know, this episode. So, you know, and I wanted to look at something that's perhaps an intuitive physiological question, but it's one that has implications for how we manage patients both in the clinic and in the intensive care unit. And we'll touch on that. And that's, why do we generally avoid systemic pulmonary vasodilators to treat patients with pulmonary hypertension associated with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or COPD? It sort of seems like a little bit paradoxical that you wouldn't want to do that.
Yeah, and I like this idea and this question for the podcast because it's both quintessentially physiological in nature, but it also links that physiology with why an otherwise reasonable assumption turns out to be like just not correct. I feel like it's right in our wheelhouse. Because, you know, immediately you have to say to yourself, like, why wouldn't giving a systemic vasodilator to a patient with severe pulmonary hypertension, like, why wouldn't that improve their COPD? That like, first blush seems like it would make sense. You know, their pulmonary arterial pressures are high. So like vasodilate, that should make things at least somewhat better. So obviously, clearly that's not going to be the case in the next few minutes.
Episode over.
Yeah, exactly. It'd be a short episode. Well, yeah, you'd think like, just bring it down, right? I mean, bring those pressures down. You'd think it would help them, not hurt them. And you know, the other piece is that it does let us look at some cutting edge pulmonary vasodilator therapy that's relevant for this patient population too. So, you know, we'll get to the paradox, we'll get to some of the updates in clinical care. So hopefully it'll be a good discussion.
All right. Well, let's start off. Maybe you can give us a refresher for those of us who are perhaps greater than 6 months out of internal medicine residency now, the main sources of pulmonary hypertension for these patients with COPD.
The main initial insult, it seems to be hypoxic vasoconstriction, where areas of the lung that are not well oxygenated experience vasoconstriction of the arterioles in the pulmonary vasculature. And that is an effort essentially to preserve VQ matching, you know, where V is ventilation, Q is perfusion, and wanting to sort of match that up as best as possible. And that's an adaptive response. Initially, it's a good thing because it helps minimize systemic hypoxemia. It avoids, you know, perfusing underventilated areas of the lung, which again, we would want to do. We want to prevent that, but it becomes maladaptive over time. And that leads to things like vascular remodeling. And that then leads to even worse pulmonary hypertension. There's also probably a role for like physical destruction of the alveoli with emphysema, right? Like if you look at a CT scan of a patient with really bad emphysema, there's a lot of air, right? Not a lot of lung. And so the alveoli are getting destroyed. And part of that is like the pulmonary capillary bed and the vasculature there are getting destroyed as well. So, Antonio, you did a really cool tutorial, I think one of your first ones, way back in 2019 on hyperoxia. And if I recall, you touched on the mechanisms of hypoxic vasoconstriction in the lungs, including some really fascinating, like perhaps special oxygen sensing mitochondria and the pulmonary vasculature. So can you walk us through that mechanism?
Yeah, I'll try to make this very brief because I do remember being totally blown away when I came across a specific fact when I was researching this. But yeah, in that tutorial, I discussed hypoxic vasodilation in the systemic arterial system and how this is the exact opposite of hypoxic vasoconstriction that we see in the pulmonary vasculature. And as you noted, Avi, I came across some really fascinating data that kind of suggested that the oxygen sensors in the mitochondria of vascular smooth muscles are distinct. So to put that another way, the authors of one of the papers I found suggested that the mitochondria themselves in the lungs and then the systemic system are distinct mitochondria. Like we have different mitochondria in those different regions of the body, which is insane to imagine. But as a result of these differences in mitochondria, the smooth muscles surrounding the mitochondria kind of react in opposite manner to the same stimulus, the hypoxia. And it turns out the mediator is probably hydrogen peroxide and not really oxygen itself. It's probably the reactive oxygen species that are produced sort of downstream. But like just so weird amazing. That you could imagine like, in the lung and, you know, out in the kidney that the mitochondria are different. It's just crazy.
Right. Both needing to sense oxygen, but then react in completely different ways.
Exactly.
So cool. And sort of, you know, if we sort of transpose that biological mechanism on what's happening in areas of lung that are hypoxic, you know, it's, if it's sensing less oxygen being delivered to those alveoli, the adaptive response initially is hypoxic vasoconstriction. It's compensatory, it's helpful, it's important. But then in the long run, it's maladaptive. And I think of it sort of like an antalgic gait with like an orthopedic issue, like osteoarthritis of the knee, right? Like at first, it helps the person to continue to walk. It minimizes pain. But if the underlying problem isn't addressed, the antalgic gait, it persists. And then you get altered biomechanics, other joint issues, other injuries. And so hypoxic vasoconstriction, it helps someone with COPD oxygenate, but in the long run, it can lead to pulmonary hypertension, unfortunately.
Yeah, sort of like RAS activation in heart failure too. Another one of these examples.
Yeah, that's a great analogy.
Your compensation is playing against you. But I suppose coming back to the original question and maybe also coming back to the heart, if someone does have pulmonary hypertension and COPD, I think the gut instinct reaction, the reason that we think we might give pulmonary vasodilators is because we think that it might ease some pressure off the right ventricle, this stressed and decompensated right ventricle. So why is that not right?
Yeah, I mean, so let's use sildenafil as an example. So you'll recall that it's a phosphodiesterase 5 inhibitor that leads to pulmonary vasodilation. Not surprisingly, if you give sildenafil to someone who has pulmonary hypertension from COPD or associated with COPD, their pulse will go down both at rest and when they exercise. In one study from 2010 in the ATS Blue Journal, they found that giving either 20 or 40 milligrams of sildenafil to patients with COPD and PH led to decreases of pulmonary artery pressures by 6 millimeters of mercury at rest, 11 millimeters of mercury with exercise. And you know, these decreases were seen even 1 hour after the sildenafil was administered. So initially you're sort of like, okay.
I am sensing the phrase surrogate endpoint maybe coming up because it seems like, oh, hooray, right? If this is a great endpoint, right? Improvement in the pressures, but there's got to be a but coming up, right? What else did we see?
Yeah, there is a but. And, you know, in the same experiment, the authors tested oxygenation and VQ matching before and after sildenafil, and they found that blood oxygen levels decreased despite the pulmonary pressures decreasing as well. So again, not the way that you would want things to go. But before we go any further, let's take a break to hear from one of the sponsors of this episode.
Whether you're staying in or on the go, Cozy Earth should be your number one destination to find comfort this summer. Experience the temperature-regulating magic of Cozy Earth bedding, perfect for any climate you encounter on your travels. No matter where you roam, whether it's a long-delayed vacation or your overnight call room, Cozy Earth bedding will keep you cozy and comfortable.
Indulge in superior softness with unmatched fabric, materials, and weave, equipped to encounter any adventure during your travels. Wrap yourself in the luxury you deserve, whether you're exploring exotic locales or simply dreaming of your next getaway. Honestly, you know, we joke, but can you imagine how great these would be to make a call room feel cozy on night float?
Experience the quality and longevity that lasts the journey with Cozy Earth, backed by a 100-night sleep trial and a 10-year warranty. Rest easy knowing your travel companion will stand the test of time, just like your favorite travel memories. Incorporate Cozy Earth products into your travel self-care routine to enhance your sleep quality and overall wellness on the road. I can say from my own personal experience, having used these sheets, Cozy Earth, they're soft. They do feel luxurious. They are on par or better than any hotel bedding that I've experienced. So definitely worth a try. Use code CURIOUS for 35% off at CozyEarth.com and embark on your travels in comfort. Again, promo code CURIOUS, that's CURIOUS, for 35% off at CozyEarth.com, because every journey is elevated with Cozy Earth.
All right. So before the break, we were talking about some conflicting results where we saw that sildenafil decreased pulmonary arterial pressures and pulmonary hypertension that's from COPD, which we assumed would be a good thing, but blood oxygen levels still went down. And I, you know, I've never had a patient tell me, thank you, doctor, for changing the numbers on the PA catheter. Well, I didn't feel better. So Avi, help us square the circle. Why did blood oxygen levels go down even when pulmonary arterial pressures went also down?
Yeah, I mean, so the key is, where is pulmonary vasodilation happening, right? So vasodilation in healthier participatory alveoli, that's a good thing. But what we don't want is for more poorly ventilated, relatively hypoxic areas of the lung to vasodilate. You know, that's going to draw more blood there and sort of worsen that VQ matching that you're trying to maintain. So when you give a systemic pulmonary vasodilator like sildenafil, it's going to vasodilate every part of the lung that it has access to, which of course ends up being all areas, whether healthier or not. So if you imagine someone with like maybe severe apical emphysema, the tops of their lungs are full of structural damage, the bottoms might be relatively spared. Sildenafil is going to vasodilate all of it. And that's what that group from 2010 saw. Sildenafil worsened VQ matching, or another way to think of that is it increased VQ mismatch by increasing perfusion to diseased areas of the lung, drawing more blood flow there. So, you know, that's what we see.
And it sounds like what you're describing is disruption of the compensatory hypoxic vasoconstriction that is intended, like that is there for a reason.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, essentially, what you're describing, Tony, is a situation where you have sort of like a mixture, a simultaneously adaptive and maladaptive thing happening. That hypoxic vasoconstriction is both helpful and harmful. But in the moment, in terms of like oxygenating, it is helpful, even if in the long run, it's contributing to pulmonary hypertension. So giving this vasodilator systemically wipes out the hypoxic vasoconstriction. And then clinically, you get worse hypoxemia, worse dyspnea, worse quality of life, right? And that's what's seen sort of clinically in the literature base. And so, you know, there is a way to administer vasodilators, pulmonary vasodilators to patients with lung disease, including COPD, without necessarily worsening their physiology. So I will ask you what you think that might be.
Yeah, you gotta deliver it only to the alveoli that are adequately receiving air, right? And therefore that you want to have both V and Q increase. So then you give it inhaled, right?
Exactly. And you know, in the ICU, we use inhaled pulmonary vasodilators not infrequently for patients who have severe ARDS leading to refractory hypoxemia, especially if like the things that we do to try to improve oxygenation on the ventilator, evidence-based things like adequate PEEP and proning are ineffective, then often inhaled pulmonary vasodilators will be a useful adjunct. But there's increasing evidence for the use of inhaled pulmonary vasodilators on a more chronic basis for patients with pulmonary hypertension due to lung disease, including COPD. Once things like supplemental oxygen for hypoxemic patients and, you know, sort of managing their lung disease appropriately otherwise have been done. So there was a study from 2003 in thorax that reported on the use of pulsed inhaled nitric oxide, which acts as a pulmonary vasodilator. And they did that in 40 patients with COPD-associated pulmonary hypertension in combination with oxygen. And they did it over 3 months. And they found that adding inhaled nitric oxide led to decreases in mean pulmonary pressure, pulmonary vascular resistance, increased cardiac output. And importantly, it sort of for the safety of it, it didn't worsen arterial oxygenation. That's the key. And so this was one of the first trials to demonstrate that, you know, maybe you can safely lower pulmonary pressures in patients with COPD and PH.
So to come back to something that Hannah mentioned when she correctly answered your question by saying inhaled. So from like a physiologic perspective, I think the assumption here and what Hannah said is that when you give the inhaled pulmonary vasodilator, you're kind of getting around the hypoxic vasoconstriction by only having that inhaled medication travel to the lung areas that are actually participating in ventilation and therefore sending blood to those healthy areas. Is that kind of like the, like why the inhaled is truly working better than the systemic?
I think so. That's certainly the explanation that I teach in the ICU with ARDS. I think it carries forward to pulmonary hypertension as well. It's really quite an elegant solution to this problem, which, you know, when you have diseased lungs and pulmonary, high pulmonary pressures, it really comes down to sort of a delivery destination question, right? Do you want this vasodilator going to all the alveoli, regardless of what's happening there? Or do you want the drug to selectively go to just those that are participating in gas exchange more effectively? And, you know, when you're dealing with this situation, pH and hypoxic vasoconstriction, the answer is really you want selective delivery. And again, it's quite an elegant solution.
It is so cool. And so you mentioned nitric oxide in 2003. I remember this also in the ICU as a resident, but can you tell us a little bit more about use of it for COPD and for pulmonary hypertension from other diseases like interstitial lung disease?
Yeah. So there has been more recent data. There was a 2010 study in respiration. It was smaller, but it looked at giving 10 subjects with COPD and PH inhaled iloprost, which is a short-acting prostacycline analog that acts as a pulmonary vasodilator, just like nitric oxide. And after inhaling two doses of iloprost, the participants in the study, they had no decrease in arterial oxygenation, so it was safe, but they had improved VQ matching and exercise tolerance. It's a short-acting drug, so the benefits only lasted 2 hours. I'd say overall, the data sort of seems to be more mixed in terms of how beneficial or not it is for using sort of inhaled pulmonary vasodilators in pH associated with COPD. But if using them, the safest way clearly seems to be inhaled. And similarly for interstitial lung disease, there is still, I'd say, maybe mixed data overall, but there's stronger data for use in this population, specifically inhaled treprostinil, which is a prostacycline analog that has a longer duration of action than iloprost. And it actually has FDA approval now for the treatment of pulmonary hypertension associated with ILD. And that was based on the INCREASE trial, which was published in 2021 in the New England Journal. And it was a cool trial. They did 16 weeks of treatment. So really, it's sort of moving away from just like physiologic small experiments to like really a larger group of patients over a longer period of time. And they found that treprostinil did improve exercise capacity and had a favorable safety profile. So the FDA approved it.
Very cool. From the physiology to the bedside. Do you have any additional pearls to share with us? Anything about what's coming?
Well, when we're talking about like inhaled treprostinil and, you know, pretty like complex therapy, it's actually really interesting all that too. I'll just mention, I'm not a pulmonary hypertension specialist, but like sort of hearing the pH specialist talk about how they use that drug, like it's all about like how many inhalations that the patient, like, because that's the dose, right? And so it's like they're literally titrating inhalations sort of up and down over time. And that's how they're sort of getting to therapeutic effects and stuff. It's very fascinating. But talking about the more cutting edge medicine, I didn't want to forget about plain old supplemental oxygen, right? Which is a backbone therapy for hypoxemic COPD patients who have pulmonary hypertension. One of the classic papers that you may have heard of in pulmonary medicine is the NOTT trial, N-O-T-T, that was published in the Annals of Internal Medicine back in 1980. So NOTT stands for Nocturnal Oxygen Therapy Trial. And the authors, they compared the use of continuous or nocturnal supplemental oxygen therapy in COPD patients who are hypoxemic. And they found that when they combine all the patients together, supplemental oxygen had a decrease in pulmonary vascular resistance at 6 months of follow-up. So pretty cool just to sort of say like, hey, just giving plain old oxygen, you know, just making sure that, you know, we're emphasizing the importance of that. It helps.
Never goes out of style.
Yeah, oxygen, I guess, is a good thing.
It's pretty important.
But it's interesting though, because as we've been talking through this, this discussion of hypoxic vasoconstriction and specifically supplement oxygen, it makes me think of something as an inpatient doctor on the floor we often talk about, which is you'll be careful about too much oxygen for patients who have acute exacerbation of COPD, because if you give them too much oxygen, they might become hypercapnic. And I think the main mechanism there is relief of the hypoxic vasoconstriction that is what, in some ways, as you've outlined here, in the short term, the appropriate response. And when you relieve that by giving someone 100% FiO2, that relief will lead to more dead space and more hypercapnia. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, that's my understanding as well. And I think, you know, that is important to dispel, I think, the myth that some people, I think, still get taught, which is that like it's reducing their sort of respiratory drive. And it's, you know, oxygenation is really not the primary driver at all of the drive to breathe. And so it is probably more what you said, Tony, I think, which is, you know, increased dead space leading to CO2 narcosis is probably more what you're seeing. And then they hypoventilate and it sort of is a vicious cycle there. But yeah,
and that is not meant to undermine the importance of oxygen for patients who are chronically hypoxic.
Yeah, but they don't need to be 100%, right?
Exactly.
You get them to 90.
Yeah. Well, I feel like you took us to the cutting edge and then back right at the end to the 1980s with like, oh, wow, oxygen is a good thing. So this has kind of been a whirlwind of pulmonary pathophysiology, pharmacotherapy, a little bit of kind of everything.
Inhaled, oxygen, exhaled.
Exactly. Oxygen sensing mitochondria.
Yeah. So you got it in all angles. So you're going to have to like bring us home with some take home points.
Okay. So hypoxic vasoconstriction, it's the main cause of pulmonary hypertension when associated with COPD. And in that situation, systemically administered pulmonary vasodilators can worsen VQ matching, therefore can worsen hypoxemia, even when they're lowering pulmonary artery pressures, which you would think is a good thing. Inhaled pulmonary vasodilators appear to be safer in this situation because of just like selective drug delivery, but there's better data for inhaled treprostinil in interstitial lung disease associated PH, and that now has FDA approval. And of course, plain old supplemental oxygen, it's important in hypoxemic patients with COPD. It brings down pulmonary vascular resistance by minimizing the maladaptive component of hypoxic vasoconstriction.
All right. Well, that wraps up another episode of The Curious Clinicians. So thank you as always for joining us. Claire Morgan of Notterly.com is our audio editor, and Giancarlo Bonomo is a producer for the show. You can join our mailing list at CuriousClinicians.com to stay up to date on episode releases and have detailed notes delivered directly to your inbox. You can subscribe to our Substack at TheCuriousClinicians.substack.com. And this is new, you can watch a video of this episode on our new YouTube channel, The Curious Clinicians Podcast. Physicians and other healthcare professionals can earn CME and MOC credits from VCU Health just for listening to this episode. And for more information on that, you can visit ce.vcuhealth.org/curious clinicians. And as always, the information contained in this episode is for educational and entertainment purposes only and does not constitute medical advice. Until next time, we've been The Curious Clinicians.